It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the FCC issued a much-anticipated policy on internet fast lanes. We'll find out what they're looking to change and what it means for consumers. And by the way, if you're interested in Steve Paulson's book picks that he just shared with us, you can find them now on the Central Time Facebook page.
First, pro-Russian activists in parts of eastern Ukraine held votes this weekend, aiming to declare their independence from Ukraine and move closer to joining Russia. This follows the recent vote and Russian annexation of the Crimean region, still contested by the international community.
This fits into a long and really complicated history in Europe and elsewhere of ethnic nationalism. What happens when you draw up maps along ethnic lines, but some people always end up on the wrong side of the border? Well, we've got Central Time's resident historian Jonathan Pollack with us now to dig into that history. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us each month to put current events into a historical perspective. John, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Good to be back.
Well, talking about the things we're going to talk about, I always get a little nervous when you start talking about redrawing lines and people don't agree and ethnicities on one side of the border or the other. I get worried. You're not as worried. Why not?
Well, I think there are a few things going on. That first of all, from a European perspective, the lines that people were in originally often didn't make a great deal of sense. That in the empires across Europe, empires expanded boundaries, conquered vast amounts of land, people moved around in search of jobs, they were exiled in some cases. And so the boundaries on the ground don't make a lot of sense. I mean, in the U.S., we put a lot of faith in boundaries. We assume there's something there. The boundaries have been stable, really, for much of the country's history. And in Europe, that's simply not the case. I mean, I think about, I encountered some of this when I was in college back in the 80s. There was a student I met from Slovenia. And I thought, oh, Slovenia is breaking off from Yugoslavia, and this is a big thing. And she was like, yeah, no, we've always kind of been Slovenian, and so we're happy to go our own way now, and it's pretty mellow.
Yeah, I think back to my Polish heritage, and there are people in the same family who were born, depending on the year, in Poland, Austria, Russia. They didn't move.
Yeah, well, it's funny that you should mention that, because my family's the same way. That my grandmother was born in what she would have considered Hungary, but the town she grew up in was Ukrainian-speaking. And the town now is in Romania. So it's the same kind of thing. It's the town hasn't moved. But in the 100 or so years since my grandma was born, the boundaries have just changed like that.
Well, also in the news today, we hear there's a separatist movement, independence movement in Catalonia and Spain. Scotland in the United Kingdom is looking for more autonomy. So successful or not, are we going to see models of peaceful paths to independence? We're not going to see a 21st century Braveheart sequel?
I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, one of the other factors about European governments that is very different from what we have in the U.S. Is that already Scotland has considerable autonomy within Great Britain, that Catalonia has managed to hold on to its own language. That's kind of an ongoing thing in Spanish history of Catalonians agitating for more independence from the centralized government. And I think it also kind of reflects that the idea of countries, the idea of nation states, this is, largely kind of a 19th century thing that kind of replaced the empires that came before that. And the empires replaced like city states, replaced like, really small units of government organized around often like separate languages or really distinct dialects within a country. And so the whole idea of a nation is more abstract. In the U.S., yes, certainly, states' rights is a powerful part of American culture. But the difference between being from North Carolina versus South Carolina, as opposed to being from Madrid or Barcelona in Spain, it pales in comparison. The European countries to start with are these kind of amalgamations of earlier smaller states that have really powerful local identities that it's hard for us to conceive of in the U.S.
Well, and when we look at this through American eyes, when we think secession, we really have one example to look back at.
Exactly. Yeah. I think Americans think about civil war and they envision that, oh, if Ukraine does this, there's going to be a civil war breakout. But, as I mentioned with the, people I've met from the former Yugoslavia, they were often kind of kludged together as these states kind of against their will. That wasn't exactly what they were looking for. I mean, Yugoslavia, for example, much of Europe dates back to the end of World War I, the settlement at Versailles breaking up the old empires. And it was kind of, it was like a halfway effort. You know, U.S. President Woodrow Wilson was into this idea of national sovereignty, but he was only going to go so far. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't want to break things down into the Montenegrins and the Serbs and the Kosovars and so forth. He was kind of like, South Slavs, Yugoslavia, there you go, knock yourselves out. When on the ground, people didn't really identify like that in the first place.
Well, and going back, we're headed toward the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War One, and it was the end, as you said, of those multi-ethnic empires, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, in its own way, the Russian Empire, and you mentioned the idea of self-determination there. The maps, you said, were kludges, but some people wanted to fight about them. We saw wars not long after the end of World War One in the Balkans already, people saying that part should be ours and that part shouldn't be yours.
Yeah, well, I mean, the end of the build-up to World War One, there were already those movements for kind of breaking away, especially from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that Serbia had been independent for a couple of years, and they were, and I think the other key to World War One that's kind of different is that in many parts of Europe, and in like your Catalonian and Scottish example, it's really a purely autonomous thing. There's no it's not like Scotland has communicated with the Scots exile community around the world to ally with Scotland and defend it against Britain, whereas Serbia had Russia in its corner as a strong ally. And that the independence movements were kind of supported by large outside forces as a set of treaties had been signed over, you know, 15, 20 years prior to the beginning of World War One, that kind of were the underpinning of that huge conflict, where a lot of the breakaway things going on now are not as – there aren't as many alliances, mm-hmm. and the alliances that exist are more above board and kind of more logical in a way. We can kind of see that, yeah, people who are ethnic Russians who found themselves during the Soviet period in – the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, which became the independent country of Ukraine around 1990, really kind of always thought of themselves as Russians. And the ethnic Ukrainians around them regarded them that way as well. So it's natural that they would say, yeah, we have an opportunity to really declare some kind of independence or re-ally with Russia in some way. Let's maybe give that a shot.
So the contrast there would be before World War One, you basically had people setting up a bunch of dominoes on a shaky table. Russia's allied with Serbia, Germany's allied with Austria-Hungary, France with Russia. And so once one thing happens, it sets off this chain reaction, a precursor to the domino effect.
Dominoes on a table is an excellent metaphor. The one I usually employ when I teach World War One is the game of mousetrap, where you've got a marble rolling along something, and there's a pulley and a spring and a ramp and things flip around and so forth, and the stuff is kind of set in motion. But yes, it's a similar kind of thing. Which again, globally, I don't see that happening. That even in Ukraine, which of the examples you've talked about seems the one that seems the most tense, where there's the most contention about that about breakaway parts of Ukraine breaking away from the central government. There aren't huge numbers of alliances kind of waiting to pounce in there. So I think that parallel it doesn't quite hold up for the present.
Another parallel I want to get into, you mentioned President Wilson pushing self-determination, then not kind of backing off of it, and then the United States not joining the League of Nations. Has the United States always had an ambiguous role of how much it should be involved, how much it wants to be involved, and ultimately is involved in this kind of ethnic nationalist conflict?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, American opinion is real conflicted on this. And even, I mean, to go back to Wilson as an example, of course, you know, we often think about the president as sort of setting foreign policy. And I think that's really rooted in the so-called imperial presidency of the late 20th and 21st centuries. But remember, the way our government is set up, the Senate has to ratify treaties and so forth. And so at the same time that Wilson had this kind of big vision for Europe, the U.S. Senate was kind of saying, well, we don't want to get involved in these kind of things.
We're in a big war. We don't want to get sucked into another.
Yeah, that the U.S. was sending mixed messages all along. And it's important also to go back to Wilson and World War One for a minute, to remember that Europe's only part of the story, that other countries around the world kind of saw what the U.S. was doing and urged American negotiators to include them, notably Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Ho Chi Minh was living in Paris at the time that the Versailles negotiations were going on. He approached the Allied delegation and asked for self-determination for Vietnam, and they gave him the brush off. He was working in a hotel. They thought, here's this guy working in the, you know, catering outfit of a hotel asking for, no, we're not going to grant that. And so, of course, in the eyes of the United States, France was entitled to hold on to Indochina. And we kind of know what came of that later.
We're putting the latest news from Russia, Ukraine, and elsewhere in some historical context, looking back at the history of drawing national maps and how ethnic lines fit into that and how sometimes it's led to conflict, separatism, war, and sometimes it hasn't. You could join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Is this going to be an issue forever, or do you see a day, maybe that's today, when ethnic tensions start to be less important as a driver of international conflict? Again, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk@wpr.org. We continue our monthly look at modern news in historical context with our history guy, Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. This week, with ethnic Russians in parts of Ukraine voting for independence and other independence movements around the world, we look back at the history of ethnic nationalism and how we draw national boundaries. You can join the conversation with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. What do you think of the American role? Should there be one in these kind of stories around the world? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go straight to the phones. We've got Kate on the line in Prairie Farm. Kate, hi.
Hi. I'm enjoying the conversation, and I just wanted to add a perspective. Your guest had said that the American boundaries have been pretty stable since the inception of our country. And I just wanted to add the perspective that from, I'm not a Native American person, but I think from their perspective, we've had very unstable boundaries that have expanded and expanded. And we have functioned very much like a colonial power in the rest of the world. So I think it's an important point to make that we haven't really respected very many boundaries we have not respected.
Kate, thanks a lot for bringing that up. I think that is definitely something that fits this conversation.
And actually, thank you so much for bringing that up, because during the break, this phrase kind of floated into my head, and the phrase was settler society. So this gives me a great opening to talk about this for a little bit here. So yeah, the caller is spot on. I was when I was saying that, I left some words out. It was kind of a condensed point. What I was trying to say is that the U.S. hasn't been kind of redefined like as Poland has,
right,
where outside forces have reduced and shrunk the side. But the caller is 100% correct. When we look at the history of the United States from a Native American perspective, yes, the boundary's been highly unstable and arbitrarily drawn, and sovereignty's been challenged and so forth. And to get back to this term settler society I kicked off at the beginning of this comment, that's one of the things when in Rob's point where you were talking about countries that have had their boundaries expand and contract different ethnic groups battling for sovereignty and so forth. I think one of the things the U.S. has in common with other settler societies, so by this other settler societies would be most of the nations of the Americas, as well as South Africa, as well as Israel, as well as Australia, is that in that case, as the settlers come in, the settlers have a unified identity. Mm-hmm. And the settler's identity becomes really the identity of the nation. And then the conflict there, the ongoing conflict that simmers and doesn't quite get resolved, is, as the caller pointed out, the conflict between the settlers and their descendants and the indigenous peoples and their descendants. And when we're talking about Europe, you don't have, with the possible exception of, like, you could look at Scandinavia and the Lapps in Lapland in the northern parts of Scandinavia up on the Arctic Ocean. Mm-hmm. With the exception of Lapp issues, issues with indigenous Siberians in the far eastern reaches of Russia, you don't have that same kind of thing. Scotland and England, no. The Picts and the Angles and the Saxons, they've been
it's
at it for,
bit, yeah,
for forever. Nobody really has first claim to it exactly. Catalonia and Spain, likewise. Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, as we're talking about, kind of in that same boat. So, yeah, the caller raised an important point, and I thank you for that, for letting me kind of clarify these remarks vis-a-vis the United States.
Well, and I think about a fairly modern phrase, ethnic cleansing, moving populations to make them match boundaries. And I thought back to the Trail of Tears in particular as an example of that happening here. We decide this is American, this group that was here already doesn't fit.
Yeah, and I think and part of ethnic cleansing and why the at least at this point the movements for separation in Europe currently don't quite fit that are that ethnic cleansing generally is it takes place when one side of the equation vastly outguns the other, and that in Europe one of the reasons for sort of the splintering along ethnic lines that we're seeing in many parts of Europe since the end of the Cold War results in there's no dominant power. There isn't one side that can completely extinguish or attempt to extinguish a culture as the U.S. did to the Cherokee in the 1830s. And all sides are kind of equal. And as a result, I think that's one of the things if we were going to be sort of sociological about this and try to chart out when do ethnic boundaries become violent and when are they pretty chill? It's like if both sides are pretty evenly matched, then nobody has an incentive to dominate the other. You get something like the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Czechoslovakia was kind of an imaginary construct anyway. You've got people speaking two different languages, and yeah, they get along fine.
Go back to our callers. We've got Lisa in Duluth, Minnesota. Lisa, hi.
Hi. You know, mentioning Lapland makes me think of Finland, which was what I was calling anyway. I have Finnish ancestry, and so the perspective I've been taught is that Russia has encroached on and absolutely taken away land from Finland. So given that they seem to be on the move again, I mean, do you have any sense of, you know, the historical context of that story? And certainly from the Finnish perspective, it was not low-key at all.
Well,
and
this
predictions
is
about how this might move forward.
Yeah, as far as contemporary Finnish issues, I have to admit I haven't been following that closely. You're absolutely correct that Russia has had designs on Finland in the past, part of Finnish independence, in addition to breaking away from Sweden, was at the same time keeping themselves on guard against Russia, it's a border that doesn't really follow like a natural boundary. It's in dispute. There are people on, you know, there are Finns living on both sides of that, what ultimately is kind of an imaginary border. So I think that there's definitely a thought of that. I think what's different between what we're seeing in Ukraine and what we're seeing in Russia is that in Ukraine, you've got people who are ethnic Russians who either moved there voluntarily or were moved there and have lived there for a while, where in the case of Finland, Russia was claiming territory from people who were identified as Finns. I think Finland is much more analogous to concerns that pop up from time to time in the Baltic states, in Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia, about Russian expansion, that Russia might lay claim to those areas as well, because that's a really consistent history. If there were large numbers of ethnic Russians in Finland, then I think the two situations would be more closely related. But yeah, Finnish history is what I know of it is fascinating. And it also, maybe on a future show, we'll talk about its huge importance for life in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest more generally.
Well, I wanted to bring up one more era briefly, the breakup of Yugoslavia. You've mentioned it. That obviously did turn very violent. So the United States ended up playing a role in Kosovo in particular. Is there any do you think that there will be leaders of ethnic movements, whether we're talking in Ukraine and ethnic Russians or elsewhere in the region, that might end up modeling themselves on Serbian nationalism, Croatian nationalism and so on?
Yeah, well, I think you raise the examples of violence, and certainly in Serbia, Kosovo, Croatia, Bosnia, these areas were beset by violence like that, really brutal ongoing conflicts in the 90s. But as I mentioned before, Slovenia, no. Slovenia didn't have that. Macedonia, also no. So once Montenegro split off from Serbia, there also that was a relatively peaceful split. So I think in those cases, thinking back to Bosnia in particular, Bosnia was an area where again, you have people of different, you have Serbians and ethnic Serbians and ethnic Bosnians kind of in like alternating valleys. And so countries that are set up like that, I think the potential for civil war and the potential for a violent solution to the idea of ethnic nationalism is really prevalent, because then the two groups are within an area about 50-50 and it's not resolved. Whereas in other parts of Yugoslavia, there wasn't a whole lot of Serbian penetration into Slovenia at the far northern end of the former Yugoslavia, nor into Macedonia at the far southern end. So those areas had a more amicable split as Yugoslavia became several independent countries.
John, we'll wrap up that topic. Another thing we'd thrown out there is sports and politics with the World Cup coming up. Are you a soccer guy? Are you going to be watching the World Cup in Brazil?
Going to Brazil for it. No, I'm sure World Cup is going to be on. My son's an avid soccer player. My wife played soccer in college. So, we're definitely among people who were born in the United States to American-born parents and, in some cases, grandparents. We're a big soccer household. We'll be on that.
All right, John, thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and resident historian here at Central Time. He joins us each month to give some historical perspective on what's going on in the news.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we get an inside tour of a Racine Tower designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, just opened up to the public.
First, the Federal Communication Commission today approved a plan which will allow broadband providers to charge websites a priority rate for faster internet service. The proposal would essentially create two streams of internet service, a fast lane offered at a premium rate, and everything else.
Observers say this could dramatically reshape the way users surf and experience the internet. It could open the door to internet service providers charging websites for higher quality delivery of their content to consumers.
So what does this mean for internet users and website content providers? Huffington Post reporter Matt Sledge has been covering the issue. He joins us now. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Matt, you've been following and reporting on this net neutrality issue and today's FCC announcement. Tell us a little bit about what it says.
So we actually don't know what it says yet, because the FCC is a little bit secretive, and when they vote on what they something like they voted today, it takes them a little while to actually put out the text of it. Technically, it's called a notice for proposed rulemaking. But what we do know from public comments that the commissioners have made is basically that the FCC's chairman, Tom Wheeler, is envisioning this kind of early stage plan that might let your internet service provider, your broadband company, charge websites like Netflix for quick access for ordinary folks. It's important to keep in mind that this is just kind of the vote today just kind of kicked off the discussion. People have 120 days to comment.
And so essentially what the headline is then is that there could be a fast lane of the internet if content providers want to pay a little bit more, and then for maybe smaller companies, I guess, or other people who don't want to pay more, slower service.
Yeah, that could happen. It won't happen tomorrow, but eventually we could see an internet where maybe you and I as customers have to pay more for quicker internet, or maybe companies like Netflix have to pay more to get their content to us, but it would mark a rather dramatic shift from the way things have generally worked until now, where everybody has basically equal access on all sides.
So what is driving this change right now?
I think the big thing that's driving it is changes in the industry itself. We are using websites like Netflix that pump out a lot of traffic, these big video sites. So whereas in the past, if we were all just sending emails, it wasn't as big a deal. We weren't using up as much of the pipe, but we're kind of coming up toward the limit of what the pipes that the internet runs over can deliver to us. So the big question is, if we want to upgrade those pipes, who's going to pay? Is it going to be the broadband companies? Is it going to be companies like Netflix? Is it going to be you or me?
And these proposals, they come after the latest volley of talks and criticism and all of that between internet providers, content providers, and consumers. Can you frame a little bit of the debate for us about, who's angling for which sort of a scenario to unfold here?
Sure. These big big broadband companies like Verizon and AT&T and Comcast and so on, they want the FCC to adopt what they call a light touch approach, basically to butt its head out. And some of their allies in Congress, particularly the congressional Republicans, but also a number of Democrats, back them. They say it's not appropriate for the FCC to do any sort of regulation of the internet. And on the other side, you have these companies like Netflix and Google and so on that want access to their customers without having to pay more for it. And then you have consumer activists and so on, who are generally more on the left side of the spectrum, although that's not always the case, who say we have to have an open internet, and the only way to get that is by the FCC stepping in and preventing the so-called fast lanes from taking off in the first place.
So as a consumer, I guess the fear is that, you know, Netflix gets charged more and they pass along that extra money to the consumer and then prices go up, you know, from people's pocketbooks who are paying at home. How likely is that scenario to unfold, do you think?
We don't know. We're 120 days off from, even having something like an official position from the FCC. And then we are years off from knowing the future. And that's one of the tricky, really tricky things talking about net neutrality. The FCC is trying to create these regulations or not create regulations, even as the industry is evolving before our eyes. So they're really trying to hit a moving target.
Well, let's talk net neutrality as a broader concept for a moment. So as
sure.
I understand it, the principle of net neutrality states that internet service providers and governments should treat all data on the internet equally, should not discriminate or charge differentially by user, by content, by site, platform, application. So based on what we know about these proposals, does this violate the basic tenet of net neutrality on which the internet is founded?
That's where things get really controversial, because the FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, the FCC favors a different phrase, open internet, but he basically says, oh yeah, my plan is net neutrality, and we can create fast lanes maybe without also creating slow lanes. Some of the advocates who are criticizing the tack the agency is taking say that's nonsense. You can't create a fast lane without shunting some other people off to the side, to this slow lane. And a big debate is, over whether the broadband providers can ever charge anybody for quick access to their customers. Tom Wheeler thinks that maybe they can do that and we can still have an open internet. Some consumer advocates very strongly disagree.
So speaking of Tom Wheeler, the FCC chairman, he's promising a series of safeguards to make sure that these new proposed paid prioritization or fast lane practices are carried out fairly, that they won't harm consumers. Is this something that the FCC can really deliver on?
That's a big question. We've had 10 years of debates at the commission and in the courts over whether and how the FCC can enforce and back net neutrality. And there was a big court decision back in January that struck down the legal basis for the FCC's previous version of net neutrality. Now Wheeler is giving it another go under kind of a variation on the same legal footing. But the advocates are really upset because they want him to kind of go nuclear on the broadband companies, to reclassify them under a provision of the law, and basically treat them like public utilities, like water companies or electricity companies, which would arguably give the FCC a much stronger legal footing to regulate the industry. Of course, industry doesn't like that at all. They say that it would give the FCC far too much power in regulating the internet.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Matt Sledge, Huffington Post reporter. Frank Lloyd Wright's S.C. Johnson Research Tower in Racine just opened to the public. Experts call the tower an architectural marvel. The lighting is remarkable, and its one exit is a 29-inch-wide twisting staircase.
We'll find out what else you can expect to find there from Sean Malone, the CEO of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, and Greg Anderegg, Manager of Creative Operations and Corporate Archives at S.C. Johnson Company. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Greg, a pleasure to have you along, too.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks very much.
Greg, could you describe the tower for people who haven't seen it? I understand you're sitting in it right now. What is it like?
Well, the research tower was opened on this campus in 1950, and it was designed as a facility to bring all of research and development together for SC Johnson. It's a 15-story tower that reaches about 150 feet in the air, and again, was a place where all of our research and development came together.
And Sean, in the context of the works of Frank Lloyd Wright, why is this tower important?
It's really an extraordinary space. I mean, it's, you know, for architects and architectural historians, this is one of the great iconic buildings of the 20th century. And one of the reasons that I think it's so important is that it's never been accessible before. You know, this was a working research tower. But it's never been something that the public could get into to see. And there aren't a lot of international architectural icons that come available to the public for the very first time ever. And it's one of the reasons that I personally was so excited when they made the announcements. And boy, did it live up to my expectations and surpass them, which was impressive because my expectations were pretty high.
Well, Greg, as we might expect, this is not your average building. It has some extraordinary features. I wonder if you could take us through some of the most striking.
Well, I think the thing that that is most remarkable about this building is that it's one of the tallest cantilevered buildings ever built in the U.S. So, again, it's got 15 floors, but the building is about 40-foot square. But in the center, there is a 13-foot in diameter core that stretches, reaches about 55 feet deep in the ground, rises to a height of 153 feet in the air, and all of the floors are hung off that central core, much the same way that tree limbs hang off the trunk of a tree. So the exterior walls of this building aren't load-bearing, it allowed for some very innovative architectural features from Mr. Wright in the design of the building.
And the windows themselves are unusual, right? Or at least the way that light enters the building. Maybe windows isn't the right word.
Yeah, no, there are bands of glass tubing surround the perimeter of the building. And in fact, there's 17 miles of Pyrex glass tubing in this building. So they're not windows in the conventional sense. They allow a tremendous amount of light to come into the floors, but they keep the focus of the people working in the building inside and on the work that's at hand.
And Sean, are these things that Greg just described, do we see those in other Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, or are these, like a lot of Wright's work, uniquely unique?
I think uniquely unique is a great way to describe the research tower. I mean, certainly it plays its role in the continuum of Wright's work, and you can see similarities between the tower he created for S.C. Johnson and towers that he both created and designed throughout his life. In fact, right now there's a wonderful exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art that's part of a joint stewardship of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation Archive that is really focusing on Wright in the city and has a number of towers both realized and conceived of that use a number of the structural effects that Greg was just talking about. That said, the research tower is one of a kind. You can't find anything else like it in the world, and it's just really an extraordinary experience.
And I have to say that it served the company as a tremendous center of innovation and creativity from the day that the building opened. For example, in the first 8 years that this research and development facility was open, iconic brands, global brands for this company that are known to consumers around the world came out of that tower. So things like Pledge, Raid, Off, Glade. So it was a period of tremendous creativity by the R&D team here at S.C. Johnson that this company and, frankly, consumers around the world continue to benefit from 60 years later.
So you have some huge names coming out of the building. What was it like to work there? Have you talked to the people who actually spent some time there?
You know, I'm kind of an old-timer here at SC Johnson, so the tower was still being used as a research and development facility when I first joined the company. And researchers that I talked to at that point in time told me that there was something special about this building, that the way that people were able to communicate with each other, interact with each other, work with each other, and then to be in such a creative design space itself, that that it brought great energy and great pride to the team that worked here.
How has the building changed, Greg, over the years?
Well, it hasn't changed very much, to be honest with you. The basic architectural design features and structure of the building is exactly as it was in 1950. Of course, over the 32 years that the building was used for research and development, so that was 1950 to 1982, there might have been minor variations that were made in how some of the labs on each of the floors were set up. But structurally, very much what it was when it opened in 1950.
Now, I understand that the people who worked there at one point asked for sunglasses. Is that true?
Well, it is true. Now, there are 17 miles of glass tubing in the building, and as I said, it allows a tremendous amount of light in, and on particularly sunny days, it allowed a great deal of light in. So researchers would sometimes bring their sunglasses with them or would turn to the company and say, can you provide us with some sunglasses to help facilitate our work, something that we were happy to do as a company. We're having actually some fun with that in our exhibition. The floors that visitors will be able to see, we've left just for fun a few sunglasses laying around on the countertops to remind us of that. So,
and Sean, Greg a minute ago was talking about how the people who worked in the building were inspired in their creativity by working in this creative space. Is that something that Frank Lloyd Wright might have thought of, trying to make the building inspire the function it was going to be used for?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, central to everything that Wright created was this sense of integrity. You know, when he talked about organic architecture, it wasn't just about a relationship with the landscape. It was about something being appropriate to place, but also to its time and to its function. And so if something is a research tower, he was creating something to inspire, to create a productive and imaginative space. And as you go through the space, it's very clear both how intentional the design was and also how successful the design was. It feels as if it is nurturing creativity and focus and exploration and experimentation. There is a visceral experience to the research tower like there is all of Wright's work. And it's a powerful experience.
Sean, are there any stories out there about what the process of planning this building was like for Frank Lloyd Wright?
There was certainly tons of correspondence between H.F. Johnson and Frank Lloyd Wright. I mean, they had worked together closely for, really decades and had a multifaceted relationship in terms of building of the primary administration building and this research tower and H.F. Johnson's home. And so it's probably one of the best documented creations of rights and relationships with a client.
And Greg, Sean just mentioned that administration building. How do those buildings compare and contrast? How do they kind of fit together?
Oh, yeah, I think that's a wonderful question. So the administration building, which opened here in 1939, is one of the 25 most important buildings of the 21st century in the U.S., and it's a remarkable place called the Great Workroom. But Wright often referred to it as the corporate cathedral. He said, he wanted to create a space that was as meaningful a place to work in as any cathedral ever was to worship in. If you think about that in that context, then the research tower is actually the completion of the great work of art. It is, in fact, sort of the bell tower to the corporate cathedral. And so we very much, while they are two commissions, two separate buildings, here we often think of them, frankly, as one remarkable architectural work of art.
So it sounds like an incredible opportunity for the public to get to experience this. Why has it been open to the public now, Greg?
Well, we've just completed a 4.5-year restoration of all of the Frank Lloyd Wright buildings on this campus, and it just felt right to make the building open now for the first time for visitors. And so we're delighted that starting on May 2nd of this year, that we are open for the summer months in 2014, and frankly intend to do that annually for the years to come.
And Sean, this must have been a kid in the candy store moment for you when you got to take a tour. What was it like getting through this building?
Well, it was fantastic. I mean, I've been to the administration building so many times, and I think like so many, I mean, first just as an enthusiast, and then professionally, I've been with the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation for just over 2 years. And in both cases, after I did the tour and after I spent time in the administration building, there was this desire to complete it, to complete my experience, to go into, as Greg said, the bell tower, having been in the corporate cathedral. And so it was a real sense of completion to be able to finally experience what Wright had created to nurture the creativity of H.F. Johnson and his company.
Well, it sounds pretty extraordinary. Thank you both for coming on and talking about it. Sean, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Greg, thank you as well.
Well, thank you for your time today.
That was Sean Malone, CEO of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, and Greg Anderegg, Manager of Creative Operations and Corporate Archives at S.C. Johnson Company. They joined us to talk about the newly opened Frank Lloyd Wright S.C. Johnson Tower in Racine.